Welcome back to the Combat Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Peacock, fourth degree black belt in Taekwondo and a martial arts skill training specialist. In this second part of my second Greg Satters interview, we take Greg's rationale for his use of language and demonstrate how it can be used to take the same games used across a class and help learners of all skill levels get something out of it, even without scaling the constraints down or up. Of course, we highly recommend you engage in task simplification and complexification too, which we discuss in more practical detail in part 3, which will be released soon. Quick reminder, if you benefit from the show, consider going to combatlearning.com/support to buy me a coffee. This is a donation platform that supports the show, and I really, really appreciate it. Alternatively, you can support the show by joining the waiting list for the next cohort of combat learning workshops at combatlearning.com/waitlist. So if you're excited to jump in, hit the subscribe button on your podcatcher and enjoy the show. Switching gears here, when you want to explore a skill and create a new game or a series of games around that skill, where do you start? How do you approach putting together the task parameters or the rules of the game?
I love it. So I always keep the same thing in mind, is that we play the game of immobilization as it leads to strangulation and breaking. So I never forget that objective, okay? Because either we are doing things to help increase the level of immobilization we're inducing on our opponent, or we're resisting them. Mm-hmm. So that's where we start first. So we have to start teaching our students how to gain access to parts of the body that allow us to start the immobilization process. So one of the things I teach people when I teach any segmented portion of the game, I connect the things that are necessary. So, for example, passing is pinning. So, it's only separated because they have steady states, but the effect we're having as we start the fight is towards the end of immobilization. So I never take that out of my mind. So when we start a game, I always consider that first. So that's the jiu-jitsu side. Now I start to think of the learner. What happens to a learner when they first approach a problem? It feels massive. It feels variable. They have no idea what they're trying to do or where to put their attention. So when I design a game, I start in a situation where they're connected, where they immediately start pulling information out of the environment through their sensory organs, through touch, through being connected, through engaging, because that's where they're going to feel those levels or start to feel what immobilization feels like, what resistance feels like, right? Because we do better with our bodies than we do our eyes, right? Our eyes lie to us a lot, but our feelings are a little bit more apt for this game. So anyway, I keep that stuff in mind, and then I start with a connected game, usually connected somewhere to center mass, because it reduces the defending player's mobility to a large degree so that the new player doesn't really have to deal with high levels of mobility, which increases variability. And so I start there. And I give them simple task focus, right? And the simple task focuses relate to the main task and a top or bottom position. So if we're talking about designing games for top position, no matter where I start them, connected or not, but for beginners, definitely connected, they have to stay on top and hold their partner down, because that behavior never changes. I don't care whether we're in half guard, Anubis guard, you know, SZ, Q mount, whatever you want to call it. If you can't stay on top and hold your partner down, it doesn't matter. So that's the first thing beginners learn. And they self-organize around a basic task that all humans can do. They learn how to balance and put their hands down and apply pressure, and they get to pick all that information up by resistances, the pushes, the weird movements. And so again, that's for the top position, for that anyway. So for the guarded situation, guards can't function unless we can connect to the top player. So when we play guarded games, we start connected, and we start with maintaining those connections while keeping the top player away from center mass. So no matter what connection we start with, no matter how complex it looks, the first game is always make and maintain connection and use it to keep them away from your hips, chest, shoulders, and back.
Okay.
Okay. And then now, if you're in a pin, if you're being held to the floor, we need to generate motion. So we start with games where we pick one of those four things: pushing, getting our limbs back near us, rotating our bodies, or pushing off the floor as a way to generate motion. And again, escaping pins is a tiny bit more vague because it's an inefficient position. It's a little harder to self-organize around because you're dealing with so much pressure coming from everywhere. So we play very little games there. Like, okay, we're going to start on our side, because being able to get to your side and stay there is how we learn how to organize around rotation. So I might give them a game where they get to experience rotation and as someone's trying to pressure them down. So I hope I wasn't too all over the place, but basically, yes, immobilization, strangulation, and breaking. Are we the immobilizer, or are we staying mobile? Mm-hmm. Are we new? Good. Low variability, low movement, high connected positions. If on top, stay on top, hold your partner down. If on bottom, maintain connections, manage distance. If being pinned, use motion to create space. That's where we start. And then now, where I go next is relative to the room. Rob Gray says this well. It's not what you do first, it's what you do next. Because you have to perceive to act and act to perceive. We know this. So you need to get students moving in a direction where we can start to find consistency. We need consistency in failure, and we need consistency in success. Once we can see consistency, we can prospect for what maybe we might want to do next as coaches. So if we see a consistent failure, we might need to change the task constraints to guide them more closely to a solution we want to emerge, or any solution. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. There's two things I want to highlight there. The first is that you're describing practical ways to engage in task simplification. There is Correct. A logic and a progression to the way you design live games. Designing is the biggest part. I explain this in the 3D model of coaching. Designing is the most important and most intensive phase of coaching. It's not Agreed. In the moment. It is before the practice.
That's it right. It's so hard.
And it is so not hard. Easy. It's not easy.
Because I'm dealing with 30 different bodies a given day. And I've got to look at all that.
Yeah. The second important thing I want to point out from what you were talking about is there is a sort of behavioralist assumption inside of the default traditional or information processing approach to motor behavior
right.
that behavior is almost exclusively reactive, i.e. stimulus response. Bernstein, who you alluded to before with the degrees of freedom problem, was one of the first psychologists to suggest that behavior is also generative. That means you behave to create affordances and gain more information to inform how you act.
And this is why resistance is so important.
Generative behavior. You can't learn that from drilling and repetitions.
That's right. That's why resistance is so important. That's why I argue for it. Because it is the information we organize around. It is resistance. Because that's a game we're playing. I'm trying to do something to you. You are trying to resist what I'm doing. My movements, my connections, my structures, and my motions only make sense relative to the task. And they only make sense as I try to perform the task, as you try to resist it. So we don't know what to adjust. We don't know where to go. We don't know where to connect to, how to align, how to move, unless we act and get acted upon. So if we don't understand that, how can you design a practice? So anyway, I'm passionate about this shit, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I obsess over how to communicate it, because every time I approach it a little bit different every time I try to explain to someone. And I'm usually trying to explain it to someone who's dissenting. Yeah, so there's a lot of bad faith often going on because they don't really want to understand. They only stay in the conversation insofar as they want to win the debate. And so occasionally you'll get to a point where they switch and they're like, okay, all right, okay, now I'm kind of seeing something. And then the posture changes. I've seen that. It's rare. I've seen that happen. Most of the time, they're there because they want to win the argument. And then when they can't win the argument, they invent a moral reason why you're being too mean or too dismissive and right. exit. There's especially in traditional martial arts, but jiu-jitsu is really bad with it's pseudo-intellectuals. I just think martial arts is riddled with this, but there's a intellectual script in martial arts that if you discover it, you can generate influence and pretend to be smart by saying the right words in the right sequence. However, at no point do these people ever engage in a disciplined, classical, reasoned discourse. They are unfamiliar. One of them, here's a firm example of this. People who engage about the ecological dynamics versus traditional approaches, they have a an almost universal problem with making claims that are immodest. They're too broad.
I completely agree.
They are so broad. And if I were to make a claim that broad, they would immediately jump down my throat. But they feel so comfortable or threatened that they immediately, you know, squirt the ink out like a squid in a flight or flight situation. And they just make a uniform contradiction of something or a proclamation that, like you said, Ori, that's just impossible. It's just impossible.
For sure.
Except that people have done it.
Yeah.
And they continue to do it. It didn't happen once. It's happened hundreds of times.
You know, I don't know. Honestly, it's just as irritated as I get, I know it's ignorance and arrogance combined. And that's a deadly combination. And most people are like that, especially at a distance, you know? And I think I know how much trouble I had to go through to understand what I'm saying. Like I had to lose sleep over it, you know? So they're not, you know, after they get off Reddit, they're going to, you know, go play their video games and talk with their jiu-jitsu bros about the DVD they watched last night. And they're going to, you know, train a little bit without sweating and then talk about how this buddy goes too rough because he submitted him 37 times. He's actually a loser. So these guys aren't doing anything serious. I'm not worried about them.
Yeah, and complain about finger injuries when they could just do no-gi.
Right, exactly. Oh, my fingers.
Yeah, my fingers are falling apart. Just do no-gi, dude.
Yeah.
Problem mostly solved.
Yeah.
Okay. So in your video, you released a really great, both of your videos, your foundation class, your all levels class. These are both, if you're paying attention, these are both master classes in task simplification and how to sequence your classes. I'm really impressed with the content you're putting out.
Thank you.
And I see that there's a big positive response on YouTube to it.
We actually have a huge positive response privately. Like I am getting easily 25 messages a day.
Like, wow.
Man, no, I'm serious, man. If anyone else listens, thank you. Seriously, every single person, I've talked to almost every single one of you, like 99% of you guys. Thank you, man. It means a whole lot because I'm trying hard. I'm trying to, you know, help this thing grow.
Yeah, absolutely. You're doing a really great job because I haven't even begun to produce YouTube content, which is for me the next frontier because I think it's the most important thing that I need to do now that I've had the podcast out for 3 years is to stop just talking about it with people, but to actually show. One of the things that was in your most recent video is you were talking about scaling focuses or focus of attention. Mm-hmm. And you give multiple ones that people can choose which one they want to focus on to organize around.
Correct.
Why are you doing this? What is the purpose of doing this when you give a task parameter?
Because I have a large room. And so I'll have like a guy who just came from the foundations and I'll have DeAndre. Okay. So that's the difference. And so I need to make sure that everyone has some point of focus because I can't pay attention to everybody. So what I mean by scaling is I start with the most important one, stay attached and stay close. That's the most important one because that's foundational, right? And then my students know what it means because I say it. If that is feeling good to you and you're just you're feeling real great and it's easy and you feel confident and you like it or you're bored even. Look for both legs next. So then now we're going to solve another problem, which is the mobility problem. So as the entangled player starts to defend, a lot of that defensive capability is going to come from the secondary leg. Defensive capability, both in framing and in basing. So if we access that secondary leg, we reduce their defensive capability. But it could be a little more challenging because as I chase that secondary leg, I might lose my attention on the connection a little bit. So again, if you're not, and challenge yourself right away. If those are easy for you to like kind of just put in your perceptive window here, great. But if not, man, just stay close and stay connected. That's enough right now, right? Mm-hmm. And then I give the third focus, which is as you stay connected and stay close, as you remove their defensive capabilities by engaging with the secondary leg, now I want you to look for threat. Okay, threat is when we introduce the potential for heel hooking. And so that we do that by capturing the toes. And the reason we talk about capturing the toes is capturing the toes is the end of the foot lever. And since a heel is a twisting lock, we pressure the toes to twist it. It's a longer lever than the heel, right? So if we just capture it, we can start to initiate both heel exposure and braking forces. So we can start to initiate that process. So anyway, that just gives the sort of foundational things that must happen for heel hooks to be called a heel hook. But the scale allows people to focus from a big picture thing to a small picture thing. And that's why it's called scaling focus. And my room knows what that means because I do it with the basic guys too. So in my foundations class, I would say, okay, if this is your first week, because when we do the I should call them differential rounds now. When we do the differential rounds, let's say the variability of practice effect rounds, whatever. When we do those rounds, we switch positions and then we'll say, okay, if you're new, your main task is to stay on top and hold your partner down if you've never seen this position before. I'll say, if you've been here for a few months, you're feeling confident with all that entails, I want you to start exposing your partner's elbows and get under their elbows, right? So if you get under both elbows, you win the game. And then I'll say, if that's all too easy for you, you can work all the way to a submission. And so I give three different potential win conditions or even a continuous condition so that no matter who you are, day one or, you know, day 364, you have a focus. That's all that means.
Real quick before I put you back into the podcast, want to take your knowledge and practice of the ecological or constraints-led approach to the next level? Go to combatlearning.com/waitlist to join the waiting list for our combat learning workshops. You'll have direct access to me to work through the problems you're experiencing on your mat or bounce off ideas, and you'll collaborate with other coaches who are working through the same problems. The waiting list for the second cohort of my combat learning workshops is now open. The first cohort filled up quick. There might be one or two spots still open if they don't reply, but this one likely will fill up too. Don't wait, because there might not be a third cohort and there definitely won't be a fourth. Go to combatlearning.com/waitlist, WAITLAIST, to ensure you get to the next cohort. Right. And so there's something going on with the underlying theory of everything goes back to your theory of motor behavior. Everything. If you have a faulty view of motor behavior, you're going to start asking dumb questions about what we're doing in ecological dance, or you're going to start saying things that are actually just not true. Sure. that we can empirically disprove. The theory of motor control being that you are focusing on certain pieces of information to organize your body to that effect. As you become better at the base skill, I'm starting to call it embedded skill, the embedded skill of staying connected and maintaining that connection, you open yourself up to find information to then progress to the major task goal of ending the end game of jiu-jitsu, which is to submit somebody.
That's right.
And there is actually a hierarchy to that.
We call it a structural hierarchy.
Yeah. And there is actually a hierarchy to that people feel like we're just throwing people into the middle of it. And it's not true.
That's correct.
What you do that I like better than what Kit Dale has his own way of doing it. Kit Dale is very opinionated in the sense that he only allows his students for the first few months. I think it's 3 months only to work on position. So they're basically just wrestling on the ground. And there is no submissions. What I don't like about that, it is artificially holding people back.
It's not representative.
And it's not representative too on top of that. So the defense is going to be all wrong. Cal Jones talked about this on a previous podcast where if you're too restrictive with the rules, you're going to start getting some really wonky behaviors. And you're going to organize yourself towards those behaviors and not behaviors that most likely overlap with the performance environment or the performance context.
Well, here's an example, really. I have a D1 wrestler who comes in here. Okay. He's currently practicing. He's amazing. I love this kid. The kid is awesome. But he has to be careful when he wrestles with Noah, who has no wrestling experience. Noah has gotten behind him, gotten his legs and taken him down because of the threat of submission. Now, if I were to put Noah in wrestling shoes and a singlet, this kid would fucking tech Noah in 10 seconds, right? But the second we add in a guillotine or the potential for a back take, that all changes. Yeah. The whole thing changes. So the kid didn't get worse at wrestling, but now he's got to take all that self-organized, those deep attractors, and he now has to try to use them in an environment that he's never used his skills in before. So he turns back into a relative beginner. So if we start the process of building a skill without the threat of submission, we're going to create the same problem that the wrestler who's been wrestling his whole life has, right? Now, but here's the thing. There's a little bit of truth here too. Not truth. Here's a caveat. I can teach that kid. I can break his attractor. and get him aligned to the threat of submission and to reorganize his skills very quickly because he's such a dedicated and high-level athlete. So that change would be minimal. Okay. But anyway, either way, I don't want to have to go through that. I want to be able to build them under the guise of exactly what we're doing, not a part of what we're doing. That's why I say we play component parts of the whole game. We do not decouple any of the component parts from the whole game. None.
Yeah. So the only reason I would remove submissions entirely is for an edge case, a remedial case. And usually something like that can be solved by matching somebody with a different partner or changing the task parameters.
Agreed,
but if for some really odd, strange reason you can't, removing the threat of submission could be a trade-off with representativeness that can help you get a person to organize a different defensive behavior, an escape behavior. But here's the thing with the way I approach things. People say, oh, okay, Josh just allowed me to do that. So this is where I'm going to start and I'm going to keep them here until they can do that. And then I'll add submissions. That is not how I approach it. My take is do not assume what your person, day one, no experience. Do not assume what they're capable of. Put them into whatever the most simplified but fully representative tasks you have available. Put them in, see what they do. 98% of them will do just fine.
Agreed. And that's what I experience. So, and what's funny is, again, all these people telling me you can't do it. That's what I'm doing. Nobody. I'm not lying. Nobody gets hurt. Like nobody. Right? Of course you'll have your like bumps, like, oh, I hit my elbow on the mat or they bump heads or something. No one gets stitches. I mean, the only hurts that we get are literally from the advanced guys trying to get out of things they probably shouldn't. Right? Mm-hmm. So when a guy's competitive, he'll ride the line and sometimes he'll pay for it, myself included. but we don't have accidental injuries because there are things I do not allow that I know cause injury. Arm locks don't cause injury. It's how they're applied. So if we constrain the acting player in such a way that they can't use accidental falling body weights or, you know, poor like angle that would be detrimental if it wasn't paid attention to, we constrain that. So
yeah,
again, it's possible. It's just these guys are lazy and they haven't done it. See, the thing is what I tell a lot of people, like they're like, oh, how did you come up with this? Because I constrained myself to only using it. I told myself, you are not going to explain things to your students anymore. You are not going to give a how-to. You know how difficult that was when I first started it? So it forced me to see things differently.
So. Yeah. There's a learning curve like anything else.
Yep.
Different terms, different concepts. You have to, I'm not going to say rewire because it's a machine analogy.
Yeah.
You have to readapt. To adapt to the differing constraints on how to teach. It works at every scale of analysis. People say, well, it works for this, but it doesn't work for that, right? I had a conversation this morning with a friend about it. I was like, well, would you say that it works this way in jujitsu, but not in firearms training? And I said, no, it's not true. Firearms training is a little bit different in that the only way you can safely get experience using a real firearm is on the range in sterile conditions. But the benefit of using a real firearm on the range in sterile conditions is familiarity with the kick and managing a malfunction if it occurs. And that's about it. You're training an entirely different skill set when you're managing a moving aggressor with a firearm, and you have to use a simulation tool to do that. And there's a trade-off in representativeness with that.
Agreed.
But you're not training the skill on the range, so it doesn't matter. You have to do it either way. You have to have the trade-off with representativeness in that case. And so it doesn't apply differently. The principles do not change for firearms. The constraints dictate what you can do and why you should do them.
It's a great explanation. Well, I agree. And I think I like the way you say trade-off, because as coaches, we have to make that decision. Right. So if I want to reduce something about the way I'm organizing the priority of principle focus, it's going to have to be because the effect I want or the effect I need the student to have is going to be greater than my adherence to some principle. But again, it's a risk because we don't really know. So, you know, but again, I like that. I like the fact that we think, okay, what are we losing by changing? Right, what are we losing by making this decision? Mm-hmm. And then we do a cost-benefit analysis and we put it into action and see what comes out.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think the best example of that for combat sports is intensity. There is a different level of intensity to competition than you usually find in training. And it isn't safe or conducive to learning to operate at that conditioning, at that intensity at all times, which is why in the scalable life training framework, intensity control is one of the top two levers of scaling something appropriately. And so I have effort queuing in there because I guess it can be sometimes useful, but you should be able to manage things with time constraint, manipulating the time constraint, and with the way that you match partners. That should be able to help you manage intensity in a way that is scaled to where the student is at, instead of making people be artificially sort of compliant, which breaks the uncooperative feature of aliveness.
Right. See, but you're using objective measures to control intensity and objective to what we can know. And that's the thing, one of the things I'm arguing in it. And again, you have a great definition for it. So I would like to learn a little more about that, the way you use that language, because I would like to start using it too, if you don't mind. I like that.
Absolutely. It's open source.
But I was going to say something about that. You said scaling partners. At queuing, I actually think this is not wrong, because we are cognitive creatures who communicate verbally. The thing is, we can't use a cue that has no value to the mind. So my big one is move as hard as you have to, because everyone has their own sense of what that is, and it allows freedom for people to because there are some guys who are just intense guys.
Yeah.
So again, that helps them draw it back. And there are some guys who are really passive, and that speeds them up. But I don't tell them which direction to go in. I just said, move as hard as you have to. I don't know them. They know them. You know, I'm not feeling what they're feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a level, you have to actually study psychology to understand that just because you can't cue somebody this way, like a 50% effort, what does that even mean? 50% effort for a spaz is 100% for somebody that's very skilled. So it's highly relative and subjective to the person and where they're at and what they're feeling, because there's a physiological response to the stress of training that a new person is almost fight or flight versus somebody who's been doing it a while. They're not as aroused by it. They're not as, they don't have as much anxiety about the match. The way you cue, if you're going to cue them, has to be different. So reminding them only to move as much as they need to be effective helps them to practically moderate their expenditure, because now they're not just spazzing. Now they're not going 100%. So they make sure it happens. They're paying attention to how fast or hard they have to move in order to actually make it work.
Exactly.
And then no more than that. And so there's kind of a built-in way of moderating the energy output in a way that's safer and more conducive to learning to both parties.
Agreed.
Awesome. Okay. So what are the differences between your foundations and all levels classes? How does the task simplification and the organization of games look different between the two?
Thanks so much for listening to the Combat Learning Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. It really helps us out. Finally, this episode, including the intro music, is produced by Micah Peacock. Thanks in advance, and I'll see you on the next episode.